Okay, think about this for a second. What do you really picture when you think of a car dealership group, say, right now in 2025? Is it still just, that place you go, kick some tires, maybe haggle over the price? Or has it become something, well, something much more complex, a sort of strategically positioned entity that does way more than just move metal? Today, we're doing a deep dive into exactly that. We're looking at Asbury Automotive Group, Inc. That's a Fortune 500 company traded as ABG on the NYSE. And our mission here for you listening is to really unpack a pretty comprehensive investment research analysis of Asbury. We've pulled together insights from, well, their own company filings, transcripts from recent earnings calls, and a bunch of industry reports. Think of this as your fast track to understanding how a major player like this actually operates, how they make their money, and critically, how they're planning to navigate, this constantly shifting landscape. It goes way beyond just selling cars.
Absolutely. And we're aiming to give you a truly illuminating look inside. We're going to meticulously go through every aspect of Asbury's operations. This isn't just scratching the surface. We're diving deep into their diversified business model, really scrutinizing their financial health, their leverage situation. We'll dissect their big strategic moves, those major acquisitions they've made, their big push into digital transformation. It's quite a story. We'll also look hard at the competitive field they're playing on and try to offer a, let's say, nuanced perspective on their valuation. Is it fair? Is it cheap? The main goal here is to connect all these dots for you, to reveal what's really driving their strategy, what's truly important, and maybe what their playbook means for the whole automotive industry. It's about seeing the bigger picture.
All right, let's start unpacking Asbury's strategic foundation. So at its heart, Asbury is one of the biggest auto retailers in the U.S., headquartered down in Duluth, Georgia. They run this huge network of franchise dealerships selling new and used cars. Pretty standard so far, right? But here's where it gets interesting immediately. It's not just about selling cars, which, let's face it, is a really cyclical business. Goes up, goes down. They very deliberately built up these other business lines, ones with higher margins, and crucially, less cyclicality. We're talking about parts and service. The industry calls it fixed operations, and also their finance and insurance products, F&I. And this isn't just a little side hustle. It's a core part of their diversification strategy.
Exactly. And understanding why they've diversified like this is absolutely key to understanding how Asbury stays resilient. If you look historically, the bulk of their gross profit doesn't actually come from selling the cars themselves. Those sales, new or used, they're just inherently tied to the economy, right? Interest rates go up, consumer confidence drops, car sales can slow down fast. Instead, a much larger chunk of their profit comes from these more predictable, almost recurring revenue streams, fixed ops and F&I. So this structure, this mix, it's designed quite deliberately to act as a buffer. It cushions them against the ups and downs of vehicle sales, provides a stable profit base. Think of it like building financial shock absorbers into the business model. As of Q2 2025, their physical presence really shows this strategy in action. They got 175 new car dealerships holding something like 230 different brand franchises, plus they have 40 collision centers. This whole network lets them touch pretty much the entire life cycle of a vehicle for a customer, from buying it new to servicing it, repairing it after a bump, right through to trading it in. And their overall corporate strategy, you can really boil it down to two main things. First, this relentless focus on operational excellence. That means standardizing processes, really focusing on getting and keeping good people, using their size to be more efficient. And second, it's about being really disciplined with their capital, carefully balancing acquisitions, investing back into the business, and of course, returning value to shareholders.
Okay, so let's drill down a bit into how they're structured internally. Asbury operates through two quite distinct segments. First, there's the dealerships segment. That's basically what you'd expect, right? The sales floor for new and used, the service bays, the parts counter, and also arranging the financing and selling those F&I products from third parties. In the first half of 2025, this segment, unsurprisingly, brought in the lion's share of revenue, something like $8.36 billion. Massive numbers. But then, and this part is really important for understanding Asbury's edge, they have Total Care Auto, TCA. And TCA is Asbury's own proprietary provider of those high-margin F&I products. We're talking vehicle service contracts, GAP insurance, prepaid maintenance. They own the company providing these.
Yeah, and this vertical integration through TCA is frankly a potential game changer. By owning their own F&I provider, Asbury keeps a much bigger slice of the profit pie from these products. These are very high-margin items. Instead of paying a big chunk to an outside company like many dealerships do, they capture that value themselves. It flows right to their bottom line. For the first half of 2025, TCA brought in $163.6 million in revenue. Now that sounds small compared to the dealership segment, but remember the margins are way higher here. And looking ahead, TCA isn't just sitting still. It's a key part of their future growth plan. They're systematically rolling out TCA products across all their dealerships, including the ones they've recently bought. For example, the Koons dealerships, that huge group they acquired, they're set to get the full TCA integration in Q4 2025. That alone should provide a really nice boost to their overall margins. It strengthens those predictable revenues and gives them a competitive advantage. Not everyone has this in-house capability. #, #1.3 geographic footprint and strategic brand mix.
Now, geographically, Asbury's been quite deliberate, too. They've spread out across 14 states. Historically, they were pre-concentrated in high-growth areas, you know, places like Florida, Texas, Georgia. Makes sense for operational synergies, managing things regionally. But their recent acquisitions have been genuinely transformative. They're actively reshaping their map and their brand mix. First, there was the Jim Koons deal late in 2023 that really beefed up their presence in the Mid-Atlantic, specifically that big Washington-Baltimore corridor.
And then came the Herb Chambers acquisition in July 2025. That was a landmark deal, a real statement. It was a major entry into New England, which was interesting because Asbury had basically zero presence there before, a completely new market for them. So what's the net effect of all this buying and strategic shifting? Their portfolio has been deliberately rebalanced. After Herb Chambers, their revenue mix is now roughly 35% luxury brands, 38% import brands, and only 27% domestic. That's a very different mix compared to before the pandemic, when they were much heavier on domestic and mainstream import brands. So the obvious question is, why this big shift towards luxury? Well, management sees it as a calculated defensive move. It's about building resilience for the long haul. They've described the New England market, which is heavy on luxury, as a defensive position that holds up really well even when the economy slows down. And the logic behind it is pretty solid. Luxury cars, with all their complex tech and higher cost parts, tend to generate more consistent higher margin service business over their lifespan. So by increasing their luxury exposure, Asbury is essentially boosting the weight of their most stable profit center fixed ops. This should, theoretically, make their overall earnings more predictable and less vulnerable to economic swings. It adds stability. #, #1.4 management team and corporate governance.
Okay, briefly, who's running the show? The CEO is David W. Hult. He's got over 20 years in auto retail, so definitely knows the business inside out. And it looks like a pretty seasoned senior management team alongside him with a track record of actually executing these big complex strategies.
Yeah, and their governance structure seems quite strong on paper too. They have a 10-member board of directors. Importantly, the roles of chairman and CEO are split. Thomas J. Redden is the non-executive board chair, which is generally seen as good practice for independent oversight. And get this, 90% of their directors are independent. That's a high level of independence, with Hult being the only insider. The board itself looks diverse in terms of skills, too, which is crucial these days. You've got someone like William D. Fay, who came from Toyota, bringing that OEM perspective. Joel Elsfine brings deep finance expertise, essential given their M&A focus. Shamla Naidu covers cybersecurity, incredibly relevant after recent industry hacks. And Bridget Ryan Berman has experience in multi-channel retail, which is key for their digital strategy. This isn't just ticking boxes. This kind of diverse expertise is genuinely valuable for navigating today's auto world. Provides real strategic guidance. Plus, their executive pay structure is designed as pay for results. A big chunk of executive bonuses is tied directly to hitting specific targets, things like EBITDA goals, adjusted EPS growth compared to peers, and successfully integrating those big acquisitions. That really helps align management's interests with what's best for the shareholders long term.
Okay, let's pivot now and really dig into the financial story. How has all this strategy translated into actual numbers? Well, Asbury's shown some really robust long-term growth. If you look from 2019 through Q2 2025, their revenue CAGR, that's compound annual growth rate, is 19%, pretty impressive. And even better, their adjusted earnings per share, adjusted EPS, grew at a 24% CAGR over that same period. So that shows they're not just getting bigger, they're translating that top line growth into stronger shareholder returns.
Absolutely. And their latest results, Q2 2025, showed continued top-line growth. Total revenue hit $4.37 billion, up 3% year-over-year. But you have to be careful with the headline EPS number. The reported GAAP diluted EPS was $7.76. That looks like a massive jump from $1.39 a year before, but it's a bit misleading. Why? Because in Q2 2024, they took a big non-cash asset impairment charge, about $135 million. That made the 2024 number artificially low, so the comparison looks way better than the underlying operational improvement. A much better measure is the adjusted EPS, which strips out those kinds of one-off items. For Q2 2025, adjusted EPS was $7.43. That's still a solid 13% increase for $6.40 in Q2 2024, and it actually beat what analysts were expecting. If you glance at their five-year financial summary table, you see that strong revenue climbed $7.1 billion in 2020 up to $17.1 billion in 2024. But you also see net income and EPS bounce around a bit more, which really highlights why you need to look past the headlines and understand those adjustments. #2.2 profitability and margin profile analysis.
Okay, what about profitability? Their consolidated gross profit margin was 17.2% in Q2 2025. That sounds pretty healthy, right?
It is healthy overall, but that single number hides a really important shift happening underneath. Specifically, the gross profit per unit, the GPU on new vehicles, is coming back down to earth. During the pandemic, with supply chains choked and demand high, those new car GPUs went through the roof, unprecedented levels. Now, management is guiding that they expect new car GPU to settle back into a more normal historical range, probably somewhere between $2,500 and $3,000 per car. It's a pretty significant drop from the crazy peaks of 2021 and 2022, though it was always expected to happen eventually.
Yeah.
But where Asbury really shines is operational efficiency. Their adjusted operating margin was a solid 5.8% in Q2 2025. And a key metric everyone watches in this industry is SG&A, selling, general, and administrative costs as a percentage of gross profit. Lower is better, shows discipline. Asbury's doing really well here. For the same store operations in Q2, SG&A was 63.2% of gross profit. Not only is that good, but it was better than Q1 and over a full percentage point better than the same quarter last year. Shows consistent improvement. And management thinks they can squeeze even more out, especially as they get synergies from acquisitions and roll out that new Tekion system. They're focused on cost control.
All right, let's break it down segment by segment. What's driving performance where? Let's start with new vehicles. Revenue there was up 6% year over year in Q2, hitting $2.3 billion. That's positive, suggests inventory is flowing better and people are still buying. But, like you just said, profitability is getting squeezed as those per-unit profits normalize downwards.
Right. Now, the used vehicle segment, that's facing more significant challenges right now. Used retail revenue actually fell 3% year over year in Q2, and it's really getting hit from both sides. On the demand side, you've got higher interest rates making financing tougher, impacting affordability. That pushes some buyers out. On the supply side, there's still a shortage of good quality, low mileage, late model used cars. That's a hangover from fewer new cars being sold and leased during the pandemic years.
Yeah.
Less supply coming back in. But then you get to parts and service. Fixed operations. This is the financial anchor for Asbury. This segment is just a consistent growth engine. In Q2, same store gross profit from parts and service grew a really strong 7%. And there are powerful underlying trends helping them here. One, the average age of cars on U.S. roads keeps climbing. It's now 14.5 years old. Older cars need more fixing. Two, cars are getting way more complex technologically. That means more repairs need the specialized tools and training that franchise dealers have. Drives business their way. Their gross profit margin in fixed ops was an incredible 59.2% in Q2. And crucially, their fixed absorption rate was over 100%. That's a huge deal. It means the profit from just parts and service alone covered all the dealership's fixed overhead costs. Rent, utilities, admin salaries, everything. So essentially, every dollar of gross profit they make selling a new or used car drops straight to the bottom line. Fixed ops pays the bills.
Wow. Okay. And the last piece, finance and insurance, F&I. Usually a big profit center, too. Yeah, but that segment showed some definite signs of strain in Q2. Both revenue and gross profit were down 5% and 4% respectively. Seems like higher interest rates made some F&I products less attractive or affordable, and lenders might be getting a bit more cautious, too, in this environment. Okay, turning to the balance sheet. Asbury started the second half of 2025 with what looks like decent liquidity, $1.1 billion total. That was made up of about $318 million in cash and then nearly $800 million available under their credit lines. Seems pretty solid now.
It does provide flexibility, but you absolutely have to view that in the context of the massive Herb Chambers acquisition that closed in July. That $1.45 billion deal was paid for with existing cash, yes, but also by significantly expanding their credit facility by $750 million and taking on a new real estate term loan of over $500 million. All that new debt pushed their transaction-adjusted net leverage ratio up to 2.46 times their adjusted EBITDA at the end of Q2. And critically, that 2.46x figure is above the target leverage range that management themselves aims for. So what does that mean strategically? It means paying down debt deleveraging is now the absolute number one capital allocation priority for Asbury over the next year, year and a half. They need to bring that leverage ratio back down into their comfort zone. #2.5 cash flow generation and quest.
Despite the leverage, one thing Asbury seems consistently good at is generating cash flow. That's always a positive sign, right? Needed for growth, needed for returns. They reported strong free cash flow of $275 million just in Q2 2025.
Yes, that ability to consistently turn earnings into actual cash is a major strength of their diversified model, particularly those high-margin, less capital-intensive fixed ops and F&I segments, they really churn out cash predictably. Now, historically, they've used that strong cash flow for aggressive acquisitions and buying back their own stock. But in the near term, given that elevated leverage we just talked about, the clear focus is going to be directing a large portion of that operational cash flow towards paying down debt. Balance sheet strength takes priority for now.
Let's dive deeper into those strategic moves, particularly the acquisitions. M&A isn't just something Esbury does occasionally. It seems like a core part of their DNA, their growth engine. And given how fragmented the U.S. auto retail industry still is, lots of smaller private owners, it makes sense. There's room to consolidate. Asbury has definitely positioned itself as a major consolidator, a leading acquirer in the space. And they've recently pulled off two absolutely massive deals that have fundamentally changed their scale and reach. First, the Jim Koons acquisition back in December 2023. That was huge. The third largest deal ever in U.S. auto retail history. It added 20 dealerships, 6 collision centers, about $3 billion in annual revenue, and really cemented their position in the Mid-Atlantic.
And they didn't stop there. Just months later, in July 2025, they closed the even more transformative Herb Chambers deal, a landmark $1.45 billion transaction to buy the 14th largest private dealership group in the country. This added another 33 dealerships, 52 franchises, and another $3 billion or so in annual revenue, effectively doubled the size impact of the Koons deal. The strategy behind buying Herb Chambers was pretty clear. First, it gave them immediate, significant scale in New England, where they had no presence before, a stable, wealthy market. Second, and maybe more importantly, it was a huge step in their deliberate plan to rebalance their portfolio towards luxury. Herb Chambers' portfolio is over 60% luxury brands. This deal dramatically shifted Asbury's overall mix towards premium, reinforces that defensive strategy we talked about. But, and this is a big but, doing deals of this magnitude comes with enormous risks, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Integrating such large, established organizations with their own distinct cultures, that's incredibly challenging. There are huge operational risks. Management's ability to smoothly integrate these new platforms, actually achieve the cost savings they projected, and roll out their standard ways of doing things, that will be absolutely critical to making these deals pay off long term.
Okay, so while they're busy integrating these massive acquisitions, they're also making huge investments in technology. Responding to how people want to buy cars now, more digitally, they seem to have this two-pronged approach, their own online buying tool called ClickLane, and this massive switch to a new dealer management system, Tekion. Let's start with ClickLane. That's their own platform for letting customers do most of the car buying online, right? From browsing to financing. And it seems to be getting some real traction. They sold over 9,500 cars through ClickLane in Q2 2025, almost half of them new cars. So it's becoming a meaningful sales channel, part of that omni-channel experience everyone talks about.
That's exactly. ClickLane is the customer-facing piece. But the Tekion DMS rollout, that's the really profound, complex internal transformation. You have to understand, the DMS is like the dealership's central nervous system. It runs everything, sales, inventory, service scheduling, parts, accounting, everything. Asbury is ripping out all their old, different legacy systems and replacing them across the board with Tekion's modern, cloud-based platform. They finished rolling it out to all the Koons dealerships by the end of Q2, which was a major step. But the CEO, David Holt, was very upfront about how difficult this is. He literally called it a heart transplant for the business. He acknowledged it caused significant disruption in the short term, system problems, downtime, impacting operations.
Yeah, I saw they estimated it cost them about $2 million in Q2, just dealing with the rollout issues. So not painless.
Not at all. But despite that short-term pain and cost, management is convinced the long-term payoff will be substantial. They expect Tekion to lead to much better operational efficiency, significant cuts in SG&A costs through streamlined processes, and better use of data. They're projecting the full financial benefits to really show up by 2027. But what's really striking here, and maybe a bit audacious, is the compounded risk. They're trying to integrate a $1.45 billion acquisition at the same time as performing this company-wide IT heart transplant. Think about it. Integrating Herb Chambers smoothly requires stable systems from day one. Rolling out Tekion successfully requires intense focus and resources. Doing both simultaneously, that's a high-wire act. A slip-up in one could easily impact the other. The next 18 to 24 months are going to be absolutely critical, a real test of management's ability to execute under pressure. #take3.3 portfolio optimization and capital allocation strategy.
Right. So it's not just about buying big things. They're also actively managing their existing portfolio, aren't they? Selling off dealerships, too. It seems like part of their strategy is also to prune the portfolio, divest stores that maybe aren't core or aren't performing as well. They sold off 9 stores in Q2 2025, representing something like $619 million in annual revenue.
Exactly. It's portfolio optimization. It's not just about growth, it's about profitable growth and efficient use of capital. Selling those non-core assets helps them streamline operations, focus management attention where it matters most, and importantly, it frees up capital. And the cash they got from those sales, estimated around $250 to $270 million, is being put to work strategically. Right now, in this environment, that cash helps offset the huge cost of the Herb Chambers deal, providing needed liquidity. But more broadly, it directly supports their number one capital priority, which we keep coming back to, paying down debt. Deleveraging. Management has been very clear. Reducing leverage takes priority over big share buybacks or more major acquisitions for the next 12, 18 months. Disciplined financial focus.
Okay, let's zoom out now. Put Asbury in the context of the wider automotive retail world. What are the big trends shaping this industry? One clear trend is consolidation, right? The industry is still fragmented, lots of private owners, but the big public players like Asbury are getting bigger. I saw a stat that the top 10 groups now control over 9% of the market, an all-time high. The big are getting bigger.
Absolutely. Consolidation is a huge theme.
Yes.
Scale matters more than ever. Larger groups have buying power, better access to capital. They can spread costs, advantages smaller players struggle to match. Asbury is definitely a driver of this consolidation. Another major factor is the macroeconomic backdrop. We've touched on this: higher interest rates, inflation. These create real affordability headwinds. It makes it harder for people to afford car payments, puts pressure on demand, especially for used cars, and squeezes dealer margins. That's a tough environment.
And consumer behavior continues to shift too, right? The pandemic really pushed people towards doing more online research and even starting the buying process digitally. That whole omni-channel thing seems here to stay. People research online, then maybe visit the dealership. Validates Asbury's ClickLane investment.
Yes, the expectation now is a seamless blend of online and physical experiences. Interestingly, though, there also seems to be a post-pandemic trend where people value having their own personal vehicle more for safety convenience. So that provides some underlying support for demand, despite affordability issues.
What about the big disruptors looming over the traditional dealership model? First, the shift to electric vehicles, EVs. Clearly a long-term trend, but near-term adoption seems, well, bumpy. Concerns about price, charging, range anxiety are still very real.
For dealers like Asbury, EVs are a mixed bag. On one side, EVs might need less routine maintenance, which could potentially hit that profitable fixed ops business. But Asbury's own data from Q2 showed something interesting. Battery electric vehicles, BEVs, actually generated much higher revenue per repair order, $851 versus $553 for gasoline cars. So maybe less frequent service, but higher value service when it does happen could offset some of the impact that's still playing out.
Okay, and the other big one people talk about is the direct-to-consumer model, DTC. Like Tesla, selling directly, bypassing dealers altogether. That sounds like a major long-term threat.
It does, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
In the long run, it could disrupt the whole model. But right now, that threat seems mitigated. For a couple of key reasons. First, consumer preference. Most buyers still want to see, touch, test drive a car. They want a dealership for service, trade-ins, maybe face-to-face negotiation. Second, and this is crucial, you have strong state franchise laws across the U.S. These laws were specifically designed to protect dealers from direct competition by the manufacturers they represent. These laws act as a pretty solid shield for the traditional franchise model right now. It makes widespread DTC very difficult for established automakers.
So Asbury's a big fish, but they're swimming in a pond with even bigger ones, right? They compete against giants like Lithia, AutoNation, Penske.
Exactly. And that brings up the scale imperative again. Asbury, with about $15 billion in revenue in 2023, is still considerably smaller than Lithia, 31B, Penske, $29.5B, and AutoNation, 27B. Size brings advantages: buying power, capital access, efficiency. As the industry consolidates, being bigger helps. This creates an interesting dynamic for Asbury. They're actively buying smaller groups, acting as a consolidator.
Yep.
But their size relative to the absolute top players also makes them, theoretically, a potential takeover target for an even bigger rival looking to gain scale. They're both hunter and potential prey.
Interesting. How do they stack up on profitability metrics, though? Size isn't everything.
Right. And if you look at something like EBITDA margin, Asbury is actually very competitive. Their 6.19% margin is better than AutoNation's and Penske's, and right in line with Lithia's. That suggests they're operating very efficiently, even without being the absolute largest player. Strong execution. Hashtag 4.4, strategic response to disruptors. So let's tie Asbury's actions back to these disruptors, that big strategic shift towards luxury brands. It's not just defensive for service revenue. It also happens to position them well for the EV transition. Why? because luxury brands are often the first to launch new EV models. So Asbury gets early experience selling and, crucially, servicing these complex new vehicles gives them a head start.
That makes sense. And their investments in the omnichannel experience Clicklane, Tekion, that looks like a direct response to the DTC threat, doesn't it? They seem to be aiming for the best of both worlds. Online convenience like the DTC players offer, but combined with the trust and physical presence of a dealership, plus the service and trade-in advantages.
Precisely. They're trying to neutralize the appeal of pure DTC players by offering a superior hybrid experience that leverages their existing strengths while meeting modern consumer expectations. It's about adapting to retain customers.
Okay, let's talk valuation and risks. We always need to consider the potential downsides. But first, how is Asbury valued compared to its peers? Looking at relative valuation, it seems Asbury trades at a bit of a discount on an enterprise value basis. Their LTM EV/EBITDA multiple is around 8.8x, which is lower than AutoNation, 10.9x, Lithia, 9.9x, and Penske, 11.2x. On a price-to-earnings basis, it's more mixed, kind of in line with AutoNation, a bit higher than Lithia. So that EV/EBITDA discount is the notable thing.
Yeah, and there could be a few reasons for that discount. The market might be pricing in significant execution risk. Remember, they're juggling that massive Herb Chambers integration and the complex Tekion rollout simultaneously. That's a lot to handle perfectly. The higher debt level post-Chambers, that 2.46 leverage, could also be making investors demand a higher risk premium, pushing the valuation down. Or, conversely, maybe the market just hasn't fully bought into the long-term benefits of their luxury shift and operational efficiency yet. Could be an opportunity if you believe in the strategy.
What about looking at the value based on deals, precedent transactions?
That's interesting because valuations really depend on the brand. Premium luxury franchises, the BMWs, Mercedes, Lexus dealerships, Asbury is buying. They consistently fetch the highest Blue Sky multiples. Blue Sky is basically the intangible value, the goodwill above the hard assets. So the fact that Asbury is shifting towards these high-value franchises suggests the intrinsic value of their dealership portfolio should be increasing over time. Theoretically, that could support a higher overall valuation down the road.
Which leads to the question, could Asbury be undervalued if you look at its different parts, like a sum of the parts valuation?
Exactly. SOTP analysis is really relevant here.
Yeah.
Because Asbury has those two distinct segments, the core dealerships and that proprietary F&I provider, PCA. They have very different profiles.
Right. The market might just be slapping one average multiple on the whole company.
Precisely. And that might undervalue the TCA segment. TCA functions more like a specialty finance or insurance business, generating high-margin, fee-based income. Those types of businesses usually trade at much higher multiples than traditional capital-intensive retailers like car dealerships. So if the market is just applying a standard auto retail multiple to Asbury's consolidated earnings, it's likely undervaluing the contribution from TCA. A proper SOTP analysis assigning a higher, more appropriate multiple to TCA's earnings could reveal significant hidden value. We saw an illustrative SOTP table suggesting a potential value per share may be somewhere between $224 and $284, which is quite a bit higher than where the stock has been trading. Suggests potential upside if the market re-rates TCA. #... 5.2 key risk factors.
Okay, but no investment is without risk. Let's lay out the major ones for Asbury. What keeps management up at night? First, operational and execution risks. We saw the impact of the CDK global cyber attack in June 2024. Relying on third-party systems creates vulnerabilities. That incident hit their earnings by roughly $1 per share just in Q2. A future attack or problems with their own Tekion rollout could be really damaging. And then there's the integration risk from Kunz and Herb Chambers. Mm-hmm. Integrating acquisitions this big, this fast, it's notoriously difficult. Getting the synergies, merging cultures, lots can go wrong.
Absolutely. If those integrations don't go smoothly, it could drag on performance for years. And don't forget supply chain risk. They still depend entirely on automakers building and delivering cars. Any disruption, chip shortages, strikes, geopolitical issues, hurts their ability to sell new cars and get parts for service. It's a constant vulnerability.
Okay, what about broader economic risks?
Well, auto retail is fundamentally cyclical. A recession, high unemployment, low consumer confidence, all that hits demand for big ticket items like cars. Interest rates are a double-edged sword, too. Higher rates make car loans more expensive for buyers, hurting demand. And they also increase Asbury's own borrowing costs, especially for their floor plan financing to hold inventory, squeezes margins from both sides. And the used car market volatility is a big one right now. Prices are coming down from pandemic highs. If they fall too fast, dealers can get caught with inventory worth less than they paid, leading to margin pressure or write-downs.
What about risks tied more directly to their strategy and finances?
The high financial leverage is definitely a key risk right now. That 2.46x post-chambers reduces their flexibility, makes them more vulnerable in a downturn. If they can't pay down that debt as planned, it could really constrain their ability to grow or handle unexpected problems.
Right.
Increases financial risks significantly. And they are fundamentally dependent on their relationships with the car manufacturers, the OEMs. Their whole business relies on those franchise agreements. If an OEM changes its strategy on allocations, incentives, or dealership requirements in a way that's unfavorable, it could really hurt Asbury's operations. They need to maintain those good relationships.
Finally, regulatory and tech risks.
Yeah, those state franchise laws we mentioned are critical. They protect dealers from direct OEM competition. If those laws were ever significantly weakened, it would be a massive fundamental threat to the traditional dealership model. Unlikely soon, but a long-term risk to watch. And the EV transition itself carries risk. If Asbury fails to invest enough in technician training, charging infrastructure, special tools, they could fall behind in servicing EVs profitably. And the big unknown is whether servicing EVs will ultimately be as profitable long-term as servicing gasoline cars. If it's structurally less profitable, that could eventually pressure margins in their core fixed-op segment. Hashtag, tag, Outrado.
Okay, so let's try to wrap this all up. Key takeaways from this deep dive. Asbury's clearly executed a significant strategic shift. Aggressive acquisitions, that deliberate move towards luxury. All built on a foundation of trying to run things really efficiently and investing heavily in digital tools. They're definitely trying to position themselves for the future, build resilience.
Absolutely, they've made bold moves. But we also have to stress the very real financial and operational risks they've taken on board. That higher debt level is significant. And the complexity of doing the Herb Chambers integration and the Tekion rollout at the same time, that's a major execution challenge. Plus, the economy is still uncertain.
Right. So the goal is clearly to unlock a lot more long-term value for shareholders from this bigger, more luxury-focused platform. But it really hinges on management's ability to navigate these next couple of critical years successfully. So here's a final thought for you, our listener, to chew on as we wrap up. In this automotive world that's being reshaped by tech, by EVs, by changing customer habits, is the traditional dealership model, even one adapting as aggressively as Asbury, truly transforming for the long haul? Or are these pivots and acquisitions ultimately just delaying a more fundamental shift towards completely different ways of selling and servicing cars down the road? Something to think about.